We saw last week the beginning of Perek Yudalid, really the first half, and it's a long Perek, 52 psukim long, the long, long battle between Bnei Yisrael and the Plishtim at Michmas. And the first half of the Perek was showing that the Jews have an ideal person to be a leader in this new model called Melech that we've set up. We set up a kingship. Bnei Yisrael wanted it. Shmuel didn't want it. Hashem told him, we got to go along with what Bnei Yisrael want. And we saw that the Jews had a perfect person to fulfill the role, who can combine unbelievable bitachon with his own creativity and courage and figuring out what he had to do on his own end, because the era of Malchus means if Hashem is no longer going to be our king ruling us directly, we're no longer going to enjoy the same level of Hashgacha Pratis. The problem was the ideal person to be king wasn't actually king. The ideal person to be king was the king's son. It was Yehonah's son who jumped in the beginning of the battle, took the lead, got together with his na'ar and charged into the Plishti camp at a strategic point. And he was able to figure out what their thought process would be, what their psychological vulnerabilities would be, what would be a way in which things could be set up that Hashem could step in and launch a panic among the people. And then we got to the middle of the Perek, and now we're gonna cut scene from the individual leadership of Yehonasan to seeing who's actually running the army, and that's of course Shaul. And this, the second half of Perek Yudalid, is like perfect for highlighting Shaul's strengths, Shaul's weaknesses. That's the dilemma. That's what's so fascinating about Shaul, is that he's not like a, he's not just gray. He's such a shade, right? Where the positives and the negatives are running together, and you see the things he's doing wrong, and you're like banging your head, like, stop, don't do that. Leave David alone. It so easily could have been so much better. But we feel that way when we learn about Shaul, because we also do see the positive qualities that were there. And that's all going to be really, really brought out in this battle. If we think back to Shaul's battle back in Perek Yud Aleph, when he fought against Nachash, the king of Ammon, and that battle was like Shmuel's dream, the better than Shmuel's dream, the best possible scenario we could have for what a king was going to be. And you remember Shmuel's reaction at the end of the battle: "Let's go to Gilgal, the Nechadesh HaMelucha. Let's, we're all in right now. Things, this, I can't believe we're uniting the people. Shaul's giving credit to Hashem. He's being brave. The people are inspired. Everything's amazing." So now, Perek Yudalid, Shaul's second battle against the Plishtim, is it's not going to be Shmuel's worst nightmare. That is too strong. But it is going to expose a lot of the fears and confirm a lot of the fears that Shmuel had about this institution. It's going to confirm a lot of the reservations he had, why the shift from the leadership model of the Shofet to the leadership model of the Melech was so fraught with danger. So load up the source sheet. I guess I should actually put it in the chat, because I don't think it was emailed. I don't think Emma was able to send it out, which is really my fault. So I'll just do that. Just give me 1 second. And then I'll put it on the screen just this way you have it in case anybody wants it. Go. Send. Good. Share screen. Where is the show all windows? Yeah, I want to do the PDF. So here we go. Okay. Open. Share. All right. A Taste of Tyranny. I don't know what you think of that title. I thought it was bad. So where we last left off, you remember, Bnei Yisrael began with 600 men, and 598 of them had no weapons, and also 598 of them had no interest in fighting. They were all like hiding on the other side of the hill. Yehonasan breaks the dam. The Plishtim begin to panic. All the conscripted Jewish soldiers in the Plishti army turn on the Plishtim. all the Jews who have been hiding all of a sudden run out of their caves. Massive, massive transformation in terms of the numbers, in terms of the morale. You can also imagine as the Jews defeat, you know, Plishtim, so you can pick up the weapon of the Plishtim you just killed. So Jewish soldiers now have weapons all of a sudden, right? If we think of Yehonasan and his Na'ar, so when they started the battle, well, Yehonasan had a sword and his Na'ar had nothing. Well, Yehonasan takes down one Plishti, and there we go. Right now, the Na'ar has a sword. So the whole there's a massive turn of the tide. And Pasuk Kaf Gimel sums up what happened for us in language that, especially now that we're in Nisan, we really can't miss what the Navi is driving at. Vayosha Hashem Bayom Hahu Es Yisrael. And what do we think of? We think of Yetzias. This is Yetzias Mitzrayim terminology. Hashem saving us. So welcome to the ideal world of Malchus, where we need to do our part, and we no longer have open nature-changing miracles, but we still do have salvation from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it may be brought about in a different way. We don't have the same, we don't have the cloud, we don't have the osos and the mofsim that we're going to talk about at the Seder in a couple of a week and a half. But still, this is fundamentally a direct line here to Yetzias Mitzrayim, despite the new model. Okay, till now things are great. Now things begin to go downhill. Confusing pasuk, pasuk kaf dalet. We'll look at a couple of different ways of understanding it, but either way, Shaul does not come out looking good. Pasuk says, "V'ish Yisrael nigas bayom hahu." The people of Israel, were they distressed or they were pressed? Question is, what exactly is pressing them? Why are they pressed? I'm sorry, one point before that, the pasuk had said, "End of Chav Gimel, Hamelchama Avra Es Beis Aven." So the Jew, you can imagine, the Plishtim are retreating. They begin at Michmas and Gava, which are those two hills that are next to each other, and the Plishtim are running back towards the valley. The basic geography of Israel, you have to remember, and this is going to be very important for this battle, is the Plishtim are strong along the coasts, while Bnei Yisrael are strong in the hill country. And this battle began with the Plishtim having penetrated all the way into the hills, all the way into Hare Yehuda and Har Ephraim. And the Plishtim are beginning to retreat. Beis Aven is the next hill over to the west after Michmas. So they push the whole camp gets pushed back off of the hill they're on. They're pushing them back to the next town over. And then once that occurs, the pasuk says the Jews were hard pressed. And Shaul adjures the people. That's a good word from the JPS 7:1917. What does he tell them? Cursed is the person who eats any bread until the evening, and I will get revenge on my enemies. We might feel a little uncomfortable with that language. Why is Shaul talking in the first person or as opposed to in the plural? It could be, remember the Malbim talked about how when Shmuel said to Shaul, you're going to be transformed. And the Malbim said, yeah, because the king has a new heart because he now is the heart of the people. So you could read this in a more positive vein, that Shaul so identifies himself with the nation that he looks at this, you know, I, Shaul, Israel, need revenge. But you also could think of this as on a more personal level. It might sound a little bit grating. Either way, we have the beginning of the pasuk telling us that the Jews are feeling forced, and the second half of the pasuk telling us that Shaul makes the people swear not to eat any bread. What is the relationship between those two? So there are two basic possibilities. The Radak takes one, the Malbim takes the other. The Radak says that the first half of the pasuk is the effect. The end result was that the Jews were exhausted, and the cause was the Shvua. Why are the people feeling forced? Why are they feeling distressed? Because they're starving, because they're trying to fight, and Shaul has told them they can't eat any bread. So the Radak's take on the pasuk has it as a straight-up disaster by Shaul. That Shaul either runs hot or cold. The beginning of the parak, remember, he was totally passive. He was standing down. He wasn't moving. He was locked in at the base, which was exactly what the Plishtim wanted. so that they could send their divisions all around the country, burning and pillaging and stealing whatever they wanted. And Shaul doesn't move a muscle to act against them. He was cold in the beginning of the parak, and now he like way overheats in the other direction. Not only does he lead the army against them, but he is so demanding, he can't even eat while you fight against them, that it ends up overheating the engine, basically. They can't fight on an empty stomach. That's how the Radak understands the pasuk. We can see Shaul, he can get too hot, he can get too cold. He can't find that sweet spot in the middle. One possibility. The Malbim takes another approach. Very interesting. He reads the pasuk chronologically. It says, but we need to like think what it means about Shaul's leadership style. According to the Malbim, Bnei Yisrael pushed the battle all the way to Beis Aven. And then writes the Malbim, once that happened, if you look at the red, beginning of source number two, Malbim says, Shaul ra'a bivo'o le'Beis Aven, sha'am hefsiku min ha'melchama. He realized that once they pushed them to the next hill, they paused the fighting. The battle moved on, and the people now feel exhausted. We achieved the primary objective. We defeated the army. We're forcing them to retreat, and that's all that the Jews want to do. Now, the key strategic question for this battle is that by this point it's clear, or it should be clear. We'll see, maybe not really, but at this point it should be clear that the Jews are going to win the battle. But is this going to be just winning the battle, or are they even going to win the war? The Plishtim are retreating, and let's remember, they have all those weapons and gear and horses that they brought to try to intimidate Klal Yisrael. And a retreating army is the most vulnerable army you have. So now that the Plishtim are trying to run all the way back to their base, so you can stop here and let them fight another day. Or you can go all in and try to end the Plishti threat for all time. According to Malbim, even at this stage, Bnei Yisrael are not ready to do more. They're not thinking big. They can't believe their good fortune. They got this much. They thought they were going to be creamed because they had 600 people and no weapons. This is an amazing victory. They're exhausted from pushing the battle this far, and they don't want to go farther. So says the Malbim, what was Shaul's reaction? Shaul wants to push the people. We're not going to stand just with the victory getting from one hill to the next hill. We're going to go all in. But how does he do it? How does he get them to go all in? He does not do it by inspiring the people, by getting them revved up, by getting them thinking, we need to go all the way. Think of our families. Think of Ribbono Shel Olam. Think of, you know, like Yehonasan was saying, are we going to let these Arelim continue to fight against us? That's not Shaul's language. Shaul does not speak the language of inspiration. How does he view the leadership model? He's the king, and he will force them to do what he thinks is necessary. So he says, let's take a shvua. I'm going to force you to keep on fighting. Arur ha'ish asher yochal lechem ad ha'erev v'nikamti me'aybay. I need revenge, and we're not eating. No. The kids in the back of the car, are we there yet? Nope. Right. Got to keep going. Keep going till nightfall. You might want to get out now at the rest stop, but this car is not stopping for you. Either way, either according to Radak, who says the Jews were forced because of Shaul, he just overheated the engine, or the Malbim, who says Bnei Yisrael were slacking, and then Shaul tried to push them, but we see the model that he is using, right? What is he thinking of the king? If we go back to think of the way Shmuel was describing the king to the people, you will be his slaves. You will serve him. He will take your stuff. He'll take your field. He'll take your children. He'll put you into his armies. That fear, that tyranny model is what we see Shaul doing here. He can be passive. He can be shy. But when he steps into his own, when he steps it up, it's the model of force. As opposed to Yehonasan, who, you remember, he had his one nar, his one lad who was with him, and Yehonasan, you know, he said, let's go, and he had his nar chomping at the bit. His nar said, like, three different ways, nasa v'nishma, you want to go, I'll go, I'm with you, my heart is the same as yours. Yehonasan has the ability to inspire the loyalty of the people. Shaul is trying to do it at gunpoint. Now, on the one hand, we got to give Shaul credit because he sees the end game. He is no limp, wallflower, passive leader in this situation. When he sees something that he wants and he thinks he can get, he is all in and he is commanding the people. He is assuming the reins of leadership. But the way he's doing it is very problematic. And as the Navi is going to continue to clarify, it's going to lead to a tremendous lost opportunity. As the Navi describes, the battle continues. According to the Malbim, the battle is continuing because Shaul is forcing them on. So they, as they continue, you know, you think of Israel, you know, they have those the forests, right? Like west of Yerushalayim in the middle of the country. So the forests were much bigger in the time of Tanakh before it became a nature reserve, like it is mostly now. So they get into the forest. They're still fighting. You can imagine what it's like trying to climb over trees, especially like in Israel where the forest is always like sharp thorns. It's not a pleasant, you know, stroll in the woods. And they're trying to fight. And who knows if there's going to be a plishti after you. And you're hungry. Lo and behold, there's honey on the ground. And no one touches the honey because the people are afraid of the shvua. We see Shaul has a hold over the people. No one touches the food. But who famously is the one person who ignores this or doesn't know about it? Yonasan. Yonasan, who had been leading the battle before, he was a one-man show. Now he has the rest of the army with him. So he is starving. You know, he hasn't been eating, presumably because he's been too busy fighting. You know, he didn't know about the shvua, but he didn't need an oath to tell him not to eat. He was too busy fighting to eat. But he's exhausted. He's starving. So what does he do? He takes a stick. He dips it in into some of the honey right over there. And that's all he eats. Anyone's familiar, by the way, with Rabbi Yonas and Ibeshitz, you know, who's one of the massive Talmid Chacham of the 1700s. So he has many different Sfarim. One of them is Mati Honasan, which I guess comes from here also. But he has a book of his Chidush Shaman Chumash, which is called Yaras HaDavash. Why? Because this is, you know, like a taste of the honey from Yonas and Ibeshitz. You know, you go to the other's farm to get more of the halachic stuff. His drashos he calls Yaras Davash, coming out of this this pasuk. Some brilliant honey that he has to offer. Anyway, so Yonas eats. No one else eats. The people, you know, are not happy that Yonasan does this. They tell him, you know, your father took an oath saying that people should not eat. And then Pasuk Ches says, and the people are exhausted. It's interesting. You could wonder whether the people are commenting on Shaul's shvua. In other words, are they telling Yonasan, your father told us we can't eat, and now thanks to that the people are hungry? Or did the people just say, you know, we can't eat bread, and then the Navi comments that the people were exhausted? Not so clear. Either way, Yonasan reacts in a pretty sharp way and surprising. You know, normally in politics they say, you know, you keep the dirty laundry in private, but Yonasan doesn't do that. Yonasan publicly criticizes his father. He says, Achar avi es haaretz. That word's going to be very important to keep it in mind. My father has troubled the land, says, this has been a disaster. Yonasan looks at the lay of the land. He sees that people are flagging. He's trying to push on. The people don't have any energy. And he realizes what's at stake. He realizes the potential they had, not just for a limited victory, which they're going to achieve, but that they had the potential to totally end the Plishti threat once and for all. And Yonasan is like devastated that it's not going to happen. He says, look, if we had eaten from some of the food from the Shlal Aivav, if we had eaten from some of the spoils that we had taken from the Plishtim as we're overrunning their camp, I guess, you know, the stuff had no U on it, I don't know, but we had the potential for a lasting victory. Yonasan publicly blames his father for the victory not being as successful as it could have been. And at this point in the Navi, if we're trying to recreate a story in our minds, we have to imagine what was the reaction of the people. This is an unbelievable moment that the crown, what's going on with the British royalty right now? Everyone like wants to know, you know, the the single word that comes out of anyone's mouth, and it's all over the tabloids. You know, Yonasan publicly blames his father for the victory not being a success. Presumably, this is not going to stay private for very long. You know, the Gemara has a line about how secret things stay, right? And especially in the world of business, the assumption that everyone knows what's going on with everyone else. Where it says chavra de chavra chavra isle, your friend is a friend is a friend. You know, it's in the context of land in Bava Basra. If someone is squatting on someone else's property, and the guy makes a protest. So it doesn't matter who makes the protest to, the Gemara says, eventually word is going to get back to the person who's squatting on the land. Like the, you know, it's the Jewish rumor network. Everyone knows once something is said. So if Yonasan is telling people in the army, Achar avi es haaretz, my father has troubled the land, he blew it, that we can imagine is going to get back to Shaul. And we have to keep that in mind when we think about what's going to happen later on in the parak. On the one hand, Yonasan was the hero at the beginning, who everyone is going to be giving credit for. That leaves Shaul in an awkward position. And we also have Yonasan blaming his father. It's putting Shaul in a bad position. Which, by the way, is going to be something to keep in mind generally, as we're going to say for Shmuel. Yonasan is amazing, but has an unfortunate habit, even though he's doing the right thing all the time, the right thing that Yonasan does puts Shaul in a bad way. So that happens here. Now, Ralbag does point out, we should note, because part of the discussion later on is going to be, should Yonasan get any blame for eating the honey? And the Ralbag does say, look, Yonasan presumably was a smart guy, right? Of the four sons at the Seder, he was probably more chacham than anyone else, you can imagine. So Yonasan sees everyone is starving and they're running past this beautiful flowing spot of honey and no one is eating it. So the Rabbag says, look, Yonasan should have been able to put two and two together. He should have realized there's a reason why no one is eating this stuff. So even though he didn't directly hear about the oath, the Rabbag points out that Yonasan does have some culpability here. He can't claim total ignorance. He should have been able to figure out why people were not eating from it. Okay, be that as it may, we have Shaul with his high-handed approach. He means well, he's trying to force the people on, but it's backfiring. It's only holding them back. And Yonasan is furious about it. You know, one other point before we move on, if we think about last week, we saw that the Navi was creating a very strong parallel between the battle here and particularly Yonasan's conduct in it with Gideon and his battle over there. The two people, the leader and his lad going to the camp, being far, far outnumbered. The whole wrap-up of the Gideon battle is that Gideon so inspires loyalty among his soldiers that they don't stop with one battle. They chase them again to the Jordan River. And then in Shoftim, we describe again, it's actually, I think it's a trivia question, the farthest expeditionary force that we ever have from Bnei Yisrael in the whole period of Bayis Rishon. The farthest an army ever travels is not even David, and when he's going to expand the kingdom of Klal Yisrael, the farthest invasion is going to be Gideon is going to march his exhausted 300 men at the end all the way to like the end of the Syrian desert, like almost in Iraq, hundreds and hundreds of miles away across the desert, where the surviving Midianites didn't even dream that Gideon would travel so far after them. Why? Because they were all in on catching and permanently ending the threat of Midianite oppression. Gideon is able to get his army to go to the ends of the earth, practically, to finish off the Midianite threat. Here, where so much is set up in common, but it's that piece that's missing. It is the ability to inspire the people who follow you that Shaul lacks, and therefore the strategic victory is not going to be there. We're going to spend a whole bunch of prakim still in Sefer Shmuel after this, still dealing with the Plishtim, because this opportunity here to end the threat that Yehonasan sees, and he says, Achar Aviyasa Aretz, that's the opportunity that got blown. How does it get blown? The Navi continues and describes. So the people fought. They fought the Plishtim. They from Michmas to Ayalon, right? From Michmas Ayalon all the way to Ayalon. You might think of Sefer Yehoshua at this point, because when Yehoshua fights his battle against the Canaanite kings of the south, so that's where the moon stops, right? Shemesh beGivon Dom beAreach beAyalon. Ayalon, that is on like the border between the Bnei Yisrael strong spot, the mountains, and the Plishti strong spot, the coast. Ayalon, it's in the Shvela. It's already in that low hill country. So they got them to the border, but they don't press. They do not continue into the coastal plain to really try to finish off the Plishti. And now by this point, the Nevi says, Vayaaf ha'am me'od. Earlier they were just tired. Now they're extremely tired, and they're basically done. Navi continues. There's a kriyuk siv here. How is it written versus read? Vayaas versus vayaat. Vayaat means they flew. That's the word that the JPS uses. Very important for us to keep in mind. That word is going to reappear in the Amalek battle. So they fly to the spoils. They take animals. They shech them. And then they do something that's bad. It's unclear what it is. We'll see a couple of approaches in a minute. Vayochala am al hadam. They're eating the livestock on the blood, whatever exactly it is. So we can imagine the scene. It's getting dark. The people have fasted all day. They're exhausted. They started the day. They thought they were going to die. Then they fought all day. They're starving. They get all this stuff, all these beautiful, juicy animals, and they just shech them. And they're doing something, eating on the dam. Not good. Okay. Now, you know, earlier we had Shaul trying to do the right thing, but not doing it well. Here, Pasuk Gimel, Lama Dalid, we see the good side of Shaul. They tell Shaul the people are sinning to Hashem at Lechol Al Hadam, and Shaul, no patience for this. By Yomer, Shaul says, "Bigadatem, you have betrayed." He says, "Golui Lahayom Evan Gadola, bring me a large rock." He sends messengers among the people. He brings everyone together. I'm assuming central control. Anyone wants to have any meat, it's going to be all under the central kashra supervision of Shaul. Below sachato l'Hashem l'achol hadam. You're not going to sin. Not going to happen today. So we see Shaul very bothered. Shaul really horrified by this behavior. Takes immediate action. Takes strong steps. Utilizes the centralizing power of the monarchy. Everyone is going to be together. Here, this is what we want a king to do. Of course, at the same time, it's very nice for the king to be cleaning up everyone's mess, but he wasn't leading the people in a way that they wouldn't be doing this in the first place. We'll look at what exactly was happening in 1 minute, but we should just highlight one other positive point. The Navi continues after the shaft, once they set up the shafting station, the pasuk says, Shaul builds a mizbeach, even Shaul mizbeach l'Hashem. Oso hechel livnos mizbeach l'Hashem. Right, he's beginning to build an altar to Hashem. Two ways you could understand that, and there are more, but two main ones. I think the Radak says this is the first mizbeach that Shaul built. Rashi also, he'll build many more. Shaul is from Jew. He is going to build many mizbeachos to Hashem. He's going to offer karbanos. He recognizes Avodah Zarah is not going to be there in Shaul's time. Chazal are going to talk about this. He's all in on Karbanos. He doesn't understand really what Karbanos are all about. We'll get to that in a Malik. It means well. Rabbanik has an interesting suggestion. He says he started to build this Mizbeach, meaning what? You can imagine the scene. It's, you know, it's still the day of the battle. He doesn't have time to build a beautiful, fancy Mizbeach. So he builds like a rough Mizbeach. They take a big rock. We use this as our improv. It's the cornerstone of the Mizbeach. And then, says the Rabag, after the battle was over and they had more time, Shaul wanted to recognize that Hashem was responsible for the victory. So explains the Rabag, he then goes back and he finishes building the Mizbeach that he began here in the heat of the moment. Either way, very good, very positive Shaul moment. Now, what does it mean that people were eating Al Hadam? Now, part of the reason for the vagueness, frankly, is that when the Pasuk originally appears in the Chumash, it's very vague what it means. And in fact, it's not just vague. Chazal explained it means a number of different things. There's a halakhic concept of a mitzvah which is called Lav Shebechlalos, which means a negative commandment which includes many different negative commandments. Tanaim argue if there's a punishment of lashes if someone violates one of these. The paradigmatic example of Lav Shebechlalos, where you have one prohibition in the Pasuk, but it includes four or five different, totally different prohibitions, is this Pasuk right here. Lo sachlu al hadam. Torah says, don't eat on the blood. Lo sinah chashu v'lo se'onenu. Somehow eating on the blood has something to do with divination. So Chazal explained, this refers to, first of all, this isn't just eating the blood of the animal, because that's prohibited elsewhere in Sefer Vayikra. Chazal explained, this prohibits eating an animal before it finishes twitching after it's been shechted. This refers to the Sanhedrin is not allowed to eat on the day that they put someone to death. Whole bunch of different pieces that are in this pasuk. Rashi here in Shmuel quotes one of the prohibitions. One of the lavim that's in this pasuk is if you bring a karban shlamim. So you bring a karban shlamim. What's the procedure? You shech the animal. You catch the blood. You sprinkle the blood on the mizbeach, and then you get to eat some of the meat. So you have to wait to eat the meat until the blood has been sprinkled on the mizbeach. That was one of the things that the sons of Eli were not doing. Remember, the sons of Eli were just running straight to the cow and they were fressing on steak before they did their job of actually bringing the karban. So this pasuk right here is the source for that prohibition as well. You cannot eat al hadam. Just like with Pesach coming up. So the Torah says, lo tishachet al chameit stam zivchi. Right, you can't shech the carbon Pesach on the chametz, meaning you can't shech the carbon Pesach while the chametz is still sitting there. You have to get rid of your chametz and then bring your carbon Pesach. So the same thing here. You can't eat the carbon shlamim while the blood is still there. You have to sprinkle the blood on the mizbeach, and only afterwards can you go ahead and eat the meat of the carbon. So a bunch of different things that are going on here. So Rashi quotes Chazal as saying that last one was the problem in our story. B'nai Yisrael, again, good news, bad news. The good news is they're grateful. They realize that Hashem was the one responsible for the victory. So they want to offer karbanos of gratitude, but they're so hungry and so impatient, attitude that maybe they pick up from their king, because that's what Shaul was doing in the previous parak when he wouldn't wait for Shmuel. They're so impatient that they are eating the meat before they finish bringing the blood of the karbanos that they're offering. Good news, bad news. Radak and the Ramban give other explanations. Radak says what's going on here is they were not successfully draining the blood. So there is still blood in the animal and they're already eating it. They're not letting, they're already taking the meat and throwing it on the fire before, even if you roast the animal, you have to let the blood drain from the shechita before you do that. Otherwise, there's going to be way too much in there. So that's what the Radak thinks. They're just being too hasty. The Ramban suggests one of the other prohibitions in that pasuk, that they're eating the meat before the animal finishes twitching. So that's why the Navi says they're running to the spoil. They're so hungry, they're just running to eat, and they're not waiting the appropriate amount of time. And that's why Shaul has to jump in. But the Ramban has one other explanation, which is very interesting and also important for later on in the parak. Remember, the pasuk there in Vayikra, when it says you can't eat on the blood, links it to kishuf, links it to divination, some way of trying to see the future. The Ramban explains what that meant was that when they slaughtered an animal, so they would collect all the blood that came out of there. They would collect a pool of blood. And there were ancient mystical rituals to try to get the shadim to come around the blood of these animals that they would shecht and try to use that as a way to tell the future. The Ramban suggests that that's what's happening here. And we'll see a couple of reasons why that's a very compelling read. If we firstly think in the context of what's happening here. So it's getting dark. Bnei Yisrael have just won an amazing victory. But at the same time, you have to be worried that at any moment, there can be a massive counterattack. Who knows? We know the Plishtim had 36,000 soldiers. At any minute, they might realize, oh, wait a second, we panicked. But why did we panic? It was because of like Yonasan and his buddy. It was two people who made us freak out. Any minute, they can maybe restore discipline, turn around, and fight back. It's getting dark. They're in a forest. They can't see anything. They're nervous. What is going to happen next? So the Ramban argues that is what's happening here. The people turn to a form of nichush, a form of divination, to try to anticipate what the future is going to hold. And the Ramban says that is why Shaul goes bonkers on them. That's why Shaul says, you betrayed by Yomer Begadetem. Look at the Ramban. Lomar hinei Hashem oseh lachem tshuva gedola hayom. God gave us this amazing victory. Shaul gives credit to Ribono Shalom. Vatem, what do you guys do? Atem Shalem, lelo Elohim, you're asking something which isn't a God. Begida hizo, it's a betrayal. That's why, says the Ramban, Shaul used the word betrayal. Betrayal meaning Avodah Zarah, or a form of Avodah Zarah. So that is another possibility that's going on here. Bnei Yisrael, are they too hasty? Are they insufficient? Are they bringing karbanos but not doing it well enough? Or is there something darker here? Are there strains of Avodah Zarah that Shaul, to his credit, is trying to stomp out, but it's alarming that they're there? Now, one piece to think about is like thinking way in the future, but it's just this the best part to put it out. We know how Shaul's story is going to end. We know it's going to end on Har Gilboa. He's going to be killed. And before then, what is he going to do when he tries to find out what's going to happen the next day? And he goes to Urim Tumim and he doesn't get an answer to his question, what's going to happen tomorrow? He goes to the woman from Ein Dor, right? And he tries and divination, a form of nichush, to bring Shmuel back from the dead to find out what's going to happen tomorrow. So according to the Ramban is reading what's happening here, everything comes to a tragic full circle in Shaul's career, where the first battle against the Plishtim, it's Bnei Yisrael who are doing this, and Shaul is trying to stop them. And in the last battle, as Shaul goes on his long, brutal decline, he ends up at the exact spot where Bnei Yisrael are right now, where he's telling them, "Begadetem, you've betrayed the Ribono Shel Olam." And that is where Shaul is going to end up. So it's a very tragic take if we think of it as happening this way. Okay. Whatever is going on, it's not good among the people, right? But on the other hand, Shaul is trying to stop it. So now, you know, we'll do the rest of this. We'll go a few minutes over time just to finish up the parak. So Shaul tries to get the people to go on. He wants to lead them in a battle at night. Let's continue the invasion into nightfall. Shaul says to the people, let's go after the Plishtim, Lila and Avoza, Bahem Adar Boker. Let's go fight all night long. I think the Mikra points out that, you know, you think back to the Nachash battle, Shaul got the Jews to sign up for this. They marched all night long, and there were the three columns of troops, and they converged. It was an amazing maneuver, and they shocked the Ammonim by marching all through the night. This time, they're not interested. They basically tell Shaul, that's cool. Kol Atov Be'Nachaseh. You do what you want to do. We're not interested in going on. Now, you have this amazing piece. How often has this ever happened? Where there's a break in the middle of the pasuk, right? You see there's a stuma. The text is broken up. There's a new line. right over here. What's going on? You can imagine the awkward silence. There's a standoff here. Shaul says, let's go. The people don't want to. And then you can hear like the crickets. Now, what happens next? So we have someone try to break the silence. So the Kohen shows up and the Kohen says, let's go ask the Urim Betumim. Okay, right? That's going to break the deadlock. We'll go ask the Urim Betumim. What should happen? Problem is, Shaul asks, and he doesn't get a response. And the question is, why is there no response? So, you know, long story short, Shaul is going to cast lots, and eventually the lot is going to fall on Yonasan. So Shaul is going to assume that that means that Yonasan was responsible for Hashem not answering in the Urim Betumim. And the Mefarshim then all ask, what sin did Yonasan do that should cause Hashem to not answer them? And then you have to go back to that Ralbag and say, well, he ate the honey. He should have known. He should have figured it out. It's very difficult. Is that so egregious, the accidental consumption of a little bit of honey? Which the Malbim points out, by the way, is not even necessarily a violation of the Shvuah, because the Shvuah was, don't eat any bread. So the Malbim says you could really interpret that Shavuot in one of two ways. It could be don't eat anything, but it also could mean don't sit down and have a full meal. And Yonasan eating honey on the road doesn't necessarily even violate the Shavuot. So the other possibility, we just need to like understand what it means. Abarbanel begins in this direction. He says really the reason why Hashem doesn't answer Shaul's request here or Shaul's question, it's not because of Yonasan's sin. It's really because of Shaul. Because let's think back. This fits a consistent pattern that Shaul has. Shaul would not wait for Shmuel at Gilgal. And then at the in the begin earlier in this parak, when, if you remember, the Shaul's scouts see that the whole Plishti army is in total turmoil because something is happening and they take attendance and Yonasan and his lad are missing. And Shaul's like, okay, we got to go. And then Shaul says, wait, before we go, let's ask the Urim Betumim what we should do. And then they're like schlepping from the rear to get the Kohen Gadol to the front to ask him. And then finally, Shaul says, call it off. Right? It's like, you know, he's on customer service for 45 minutes. Okay, enough time to listen to the music. I'm done. Hangs up the phone. We got to just go. We don't have time for this. Asof yadecha, he said, put your hand back. That's not respectful. Shaul looks at it as like an on-demand service, right? He's the one who's always in a rush. When I need to go, I need to go, and I can't wait for the Kohen. I can't wait for Shmuel. Oh, now all of a sudden, the army is not going to move unless you get divine approval. So you're just using the Urim Betumim as like a crutch or a source of convenience. That's not how it works. And that could be totally Mida Keneged Mida. That's the line of thought that the Abarbanel begins in. That Shaul is not going to be answered correctly, right? And even more ironically is that even when he does the Goral, right? He casts lots and the lot falls on Yonasan. Well, that's not the case. Technically, it's true that Yonasan did do something wrong, right? But you know, there's the message you can get that's technically correct, and you can get the message that's actually the right answer. And so Shaul kind of forces Hashem's hand, as it were, by, you know, I can't get the Urim Betumim, I'll do the Goral. Well, you do the Goral, you'll get an answer which is technically true, but it's not actually the answer that you want. Now, what is Shaul's reaction? Shaul wants to kill Yonasan. The people are horrified. The people say that's absolutely not going to happen. So, you know, basically the people save Yonasan from Shaul. Now we need to like think, what? Shaul wants to kill Yonasan? So let's take 3 points out of this. Then we'll take like a minute for the rest of the parak and then we'll close. Point number one, Shaul trying to kill Yonasan. Well, if we think of Shaul's political position. And Shaul knows that Yonasan had criticized him. and Shaul knows that the people are giving Yonasan the credit. The dark part of Shaul giving all the credit to Hashem, he said several times in the parak, Hashem gave us this victory. That's partially wonderful, but also there's a piece of this victory goes to Hashem and doesn't go to Yonasan. So there's a piece of jealousy there. And what we see foreshadowed then in this story right here is the lengths that Shaul might be willing to go to preserve his hold on the kingship, regardless of the consequences to those he's closest to. And we see what being a king is going to do to Shaul's personality, even with how he relates to his own family members. When Shmuel told Shaul, "You will be transformed by becoming king," that wasn't necessarily a bracha. That was a statement. You, as a private citizen, will not be the same person as you are as a king. That can be letov, that can be lera. But private citizen, shy, retiring, humble Shaul, once he tastes power and leadership, is he going to rise to the occasion or is he going to turn into a tyrant? And from how he deals with Yonasan here and how he tried to force Bnei Yisrael, we're seeing this specter of tyranny really coming out of Shaul's behavior. And that, of course, is only going to be strengthened and strengthened once Shaul begins to decline and decline and David comes on the scene. But it's starting right here with how he reacts as he feels threatened by his own son. The second point is to note that there's a parallel here that Mikra points this out, being drawn between who and who? Shaul and the one other prominent person who takes an ill-advised oath and then is willing to kill their child. And that is Yiftach. At the beginning of the parak, we had the Shofet Gidon, the best of the Shoftim. That this could have been Shaul's Gidon moment. Instead, it was Yonasan's. And now Shaul is turning into a Yiftach. You know, the weakest of the Shoftim, the one who ultimately fails to unite Klal Yisrael, even leads them into civil war. The end of Yiftach's career, there's a civil war and he kills thousands and thousands of people from Sheba and Ephraim. So that's the specter we see here. If at the first battle, the one with Nachash, where everything was amazing, there Shaul was the ideal king, unifying the people, here Shaul is being split off from the people and you have the vision of Yiftach coming up, the person who even kills his own, or whatever happens to his own daughter, but is willing to kill his own daughter and leads Klal Yisrael into civil war. And the third parallel here, third point that's very important to note, is that there's one other person in the Navi that we should be reminded of. When we think of a lottery, and we think of someone who is taking stuff from the spoils or from that they weren't supposed to have, and also using this word of achar. Remember Yonasan that we use that word, achar avi. Well, you have that by Yonah, you have that by Yiftach, but you also have very strong parallels to the story of Yehoshua and Achan at the aftermath of the Battle of Yericho, where Achan steals from the spoils of Yericho. It causes Bnei Yisrael to lose the next battle. They then cast a lot to find out who did it. It's the exact same language that's used, the extensive lottery, likud, the conquering that's happening to identify the selection of the person. The same words are used. Yehoshua even says to the guy, when he's identified, he even calls Achan his son, just like Shaul turns to his son, Yonasan. But in that case, all of those similarities are only being there to drive home the differences. Because in the case of Yehoshua and Achan, Achan, who illegally took from the spoils of Yericho, was the guilty party. He was correctly identified. Yehoshua turns to him. He's executed for what he did. And the upshot over there is that why was it Asur to take from the spoils of Yericho? Because the battle of Yericho was one which was entirely accomplished by Hashem. That was the era before the Melech. That was the era of open miracles. They blow the shofar and the walls come tumbling down, right? In that moment, that model, the idea of Chayrim was appropriate. That was what Bnei Yisrael had chosen back then. They were still being led by Hashem, not being led by flesh and blood. And so when there's a crisis, they can turn to the Yerbatum, they can turn to the Goral, they're given the right answer, they fix it, you don't take from Hashem, we move on. We have here, I think, maybe the reason why the Navi might be so clear, so dramatically comparing this story to the story back with Yahushua and Achan, is that what happens here? Yonasan is actually the hero, right? The one who's parallel to Achan. Well, Yonasan's actually the hero and didn't really do anything wrong. And the Goral that identifies him, it may not, technically it's correct, but he's not really the one who is responsible. And the point here might be that Bnei Yisrael need to appreciate the consequences of their choice. That we're not in Sefer Yehoshua anymore. And the reason is you wanted a king. And if you ask for a king, then that's what you're going to get. And you're not going to deal with Hashem. Hashem's not going to deal with you in the exact same way. If you're good, you'll get the Yeshua. Thus, Pasuk says that several times. But to expect supernatural victories, absolutely not. Taking from the spoils, you should, because it wasn't the walls coming tumbling down. And Shaul doesn't realize that. And what drives home the point is that the people successfully redeem Yonasan, and it's clear from the Psukim that Yonasan should not have been killed. Right? Shaul wants to do it because Shaul is still thinking in the old model. But you have to realize where we are now. We're in the world where the Yonasan model, for better or for worse, right? It's got its advantages, it's got its disadvantages. Sefer Shoftim didn't work out very well. So there, you know, if Yonasan is our king, it's gonna work. But you need to realize what that means. So we have similarities to Achan, but it's all so different because it's underscoring the fact that we're in a different time. The Jews have made their choice, and now we need to live with that. And you know, Halavai was a Yonasan, but instead you have the tyranny of a Shaul who's trying to kill his own son and, you know, forcing the people, even though at the same time he's trying to lead them to victory and he's trying to get them to stop doing whatever they're doing with the blood. Last point, we'll look at this and then we'll close, is the epilogue of the Parak Yudalid. So much of Sefer Shmuel is going to deal with Shaul's collapse. So we should, it like, shmushes into a couple of psukim all of the successes that Shaul has. The Navi's not interested in giving us a history of Shaul. It's interested in giving us the lessons to learn from him. And unfortunately, most of the lessons we learn from Shaul are lessons from failure. You look, and the pasuk says that Shaul, who had begun so shy and passive, hiding in the kelim, well, he fights very hard, right? When Shaul thinks he can accomplish something, Shaul's whole failure is a lack of bitachon. He can't, when he thinks he can't do something, he doesn't have the ability to have faith in Hashem to get him to the next level. But when he thinks that he can do something, he will move heaven and earth to get there. So he does what Kal Yisrael wanted. They wanted a king to unite them, get an army, and save them from all their enemies. And that's what Shaul does. Shaul lakad hamlucha. He conquered the kingdom. It took willpower for it to do that. He forces Kal Yisrael into a new model. There's a dark piece to that also. The reason why I use that word, right? There's a tyranny piece to that. He's forcing them rather than inspiring them. But his methods also have some success. He fights, who does he fight? Moab, Ammon, Edom, Tsova up in Syria, the Plishtim, B'chon Asher Yifnir Yeshia. He's pushing them back everywhere. He's not winning, but he's fighting everyone everywhere. The Pasuk Mem Chas is really interesting. It says, Vayas Chayel Vayach Es Amalek. He gets an army together and he smites Amalek. He saves Israel from those that spoiled them. Some of the Mefarshim say that this is referring to what's going to happen in the next parak when we finally deal with the Amalek story. Matsuda Stavit says, no, Matsuda Stavit actually says that Shaul launches a defensive war right here before Ez Hold. He fights Amalek, he pushes Amalek back along with everyone else. When we get to Parak Tezvav, then Shmuel will tell Shaul, you won the defensive war against Amalek. Now you have to go on the offensive and finish it off. But Shaul is trying hard. He's establishing a new model. He's creating Vayaschael, right? He's making an army. We find out about his family, and the Navi concludes, "Batia melchama chazaka plishtim kol yemei Shaul." Shaul gets anybody he can into his army. Again, good news, bad news. The good news, he's fighting the Plishtim hard. Shmuel does not spend his days as a king going golfing. You know, he's not sitting in the palace drinking his wine and eating his meat. The man is hard at work. He is fighting every day for Klal Yisrael. Of course, same time, why does he have to spend his whole reign fighting the Plishtim? Because he blew the opportunity here at the beginning to put an end to them once and for all. So that's the composite image we get of Shaul. Someone who means well and has accomplishments. In many ways, his heart is in the right place. But at the same time, there's that you can like feel it, that sense of insecurity and inadequacy. There's that inability to get beyond himself, which Yonasan can do through Bitachon. David can do through Bitachon. Shaul is not going to do. And the leadership style he has of forcing people to follow him, rather than inspiring them to follow him, is going to continue to erode his popularity. And then we're just going to get a self-destructive cycle where he's going to sense more and more opposition to him. And then he's just going to lash out and worse and worse. And of course, tshuva is never going to be something that Shaul is open to, and it's going to go down. So, you know, at this point, the battle is successful, and we're never again, by the way, going to see Plishtim smack in the middle of the country. Shaul gets rid of that once and for all. B'nai Yisrael are independent, and they've pushed them to the side. They have their united, independent kingdom. Unbelievable success. At the same time, while it's an amazing success, the tragedy is that there was the potential for so much more. Okay, so sorry for going a little long. I just really wanted to finish this off before Pesach. So wish everyone Chag.